From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. This morning, Georgia Governor Brian Kemp signed into law one of the most restrictive abortion bills in the country. It bans abortions after a doctor can hear a fetal heartbeat, which is at around 6 weeks of pregnancy, before most women know they're pregnant. That makes this a so-called heartbeat bill, but it also grants personhood rights to an embryo and fetus. Here's the bill sponsor, Georgia State Rep. Ed Setzler, at the signing ceremony.
The Living Infants Fairness and Equality Act is a bill that recognizes something that many have known for years. It recognizes that science tells us that children in the womb are living, distinct human beings that are worthy of full legal protection.
Georgia Public Broadcasting politics reporter Stephen Fowler joins us. And Stephen, just remind us, Roe v. Wade, the law of the land, allows for abortions until the fetus is viable outside the woman. That's around 24 weeks. So at 6 weeks, this bill is much earlier, but it also would grant personhood. What would that allow Georgians to do?
Well, Robin, what this would do is give that embryo personhood status. That means that parents could claim that embryo on their taxes, and some state-level census counts could count an embryo within the state census. And so what it would do is basically you are considered a person now after you were born, once you were a baby. But this bill moves that back earlier to once a doctor can detect a heartbeat. Once that heartbeat is detected, it is now legally and economically considered a person.
And there were some concerns from district attorneys that mothers, doctors, pharmacists could be subject to murder prosecution if, in fact, they helped end a pregnancy after 6 weeks. Apparently, the bill's authors say that they would be subject to criminal prosecution, but there are also concerns about a pregnancy ending naturally.
Well, the bill sponsor, Republican Ed Setzler, that we just heard from after the bill signing, answered that question and said that categorically that would not be the case. He says that the law actually would strengthen protections for women who have miscarriages and that there wouldn't be any fear of prosecution for a miscarriage happening or any sort of natural occurrence that may happen, yeah, and that mothers don't need to fear any sort of legal action for what happens.
Well, there are exceptions in the bill in cases of incest, rape, which have been reported to police, or in the case of the health of the mother. But similar heartbeat bans have been signed into law in seven states, including Mississippi, Ohio, Kentucky. So far, all have been challenged. None have gone into effect. And President Trump recently weighed in on the abortion debate, making false claims about so-called late-term abortion laws. Here he is at a rally in Wisconsin last month.
The baby is born. The mother meets with the doctor. They take care of the baby. They wrap the baby beautifully. And then the doctor and the mother determine whether or not they will execute the baby. I don't think so.
Of course, what the president just described there is untrue. That would be homicide. You can't birth a healthy baby and then kill it. Some think that he may have been confused with stillbirths, in which a baby is born deceased. But his comments are also being seen as part of a push to get these bills passed and get them all the way to the Supreme Court, which now has two Trump conservative nominees on board the court. What's the thinking there? Is the presumption there that this will go to the courts?
Well, the bill sponsors here in Georgia say that all they can control is what happens in Georgia. So they wanted to pass a bill that would be best for Georgians. But both supporters and opponents of this bill do seem to think that Georgia's bill is designed to be that test case for the Supreme Court. Interestingly enough, it doesn't actually have anything to do with the abortion provisions or the heartbeat provisions. They think it's that fetal personhood language that could be the different hook, so to speak, that will get the Supreme Court to consider Georgia's case and ultimately potentially make a decision about Roe versus Wade.
Well, the ACLU of Georgia says it will fight this new law in court. It's ready to go to court. And there have been other opposing voices raised. Georgia is one of the leading states for movie and television production. Is there a sense that there will be a Hollywood boycott?
Well, what we've seen, Robin, throughout this legislative session is a lot of opposition from a lot of different groups. We've had medical groups. We've had the Democratic groups come out. We've had Planned Parenthood come out. And we had, on the last day of this legislative session, a protest led by Hollywood actress Alyssa Milano and some local film and entertainment industry workers here in Georgia. And they said that this bill, if it's signed, could send a message to Hollywood that Georgia is not a hospitable state. And even though there are some large tax credits for the film industry to come film here in Georgia, there is a push by Milano and some local workers to get these big companies to go to states that, in their words, respect the rights of women.
Thank you, Stephen. Stephen Fowler covers politics for Georgia Public Broadcasting.
Well, voters in Denver are deciding today whether to become the first U.S. city to decriminalize the use of hallucinogenic mushrooms. The measure on today's ballot would bar officials from spending resources to impose criminal penalties for personal use and possession of the drug. Joining me now is Avery Lill from Colorado Public Radio. Hi, Avery.
Hi, Jeremy.
And first of all, just give us the 101 on magic mushrooms.
Psilocybin mushrooms are psychedelics that can cause hallucinations. And along with several other psychedelics, they were made federally illegal in 1970. Psilocybin is a Schedule I drug, so that's the same classification as heroin and cocaine. Obviously, some people who use them are using them recreationally, but there's also been quite a bit of research in the last couple of decades into their potential medical use, specifically for mental illness. And the U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration does warn, though, that large amounts of psilocybin can cause panic attacks and psychosis, and that an overdose can be deadly.
Now, this initiative that's on the ballot today in Denver doesn't actually legalize the mushrooms. The goal is just to deprioritize, to the greatest extent possible, the criminal penalties for using and possessing the mushrooms. How would that work?
Right. The municipal election obviously can't change state or federal law. So the ballot measure, if it passes, it will still be illegal to possess or use psychedelic mushrooms. But this initiative could reduce drug arrests. So essentially, it directs law enforcement to focus its attention on every other crime, including jaywalking, before it enforces laws that make magic mushrooms illegal.
Jaywalking would be a higher priority. Interesting. Right. Where did this initiative come from? What's the argument in favor of it?
So the group campaigning for this measure is called Decriminalize Denver, and they tried to get the measure on the ballot last year and failed. But this year, they got the signatures they needed. So they're pointing to potential medical benefits, and the FDA granted psilocybin-based treatment for depression breakthrough therapy status. That's a process that expedites the development and review of new treatment. Johns Hopkins researchers have also found some evidence that psilocybin could help treat some forms of anxiety and depression. And the campaign manager, Kevin Matthews, actually credits psilocybin with saving his life when he struggled with depression. So people are pointing to those, to potential medical benefits is what they're grounding their campaign in.
And what about the opposition?
Denver's mayor, Michael Hancock, opposes the ballot initiative. Beyond that, there's not much, if any, vocal opposition coming out of Denver. The public had the opportunity to submit comments on the ballot initiative, and no one submitted a comment against it. Probably the most prominent opposition voice has been the Centennial Institute, and that's a Colorado Christian University think tank based in Lakewood, Colorado, and that's just west of Denver in Jefferson County, and they're concerned about safety as well as the area's reputation as a sort of drug haven.
Is there any indication of whether this is going to pass today?
People in favor of the measure have certainly been more vocal than those opposed. And we know that the Decriminalized Denver group got more than 5,000 validated signatures from city residents to get the question on the ballot. But more than 700,000 people live in the city of Denver. So whether or not they've gathered enough momentum for the initiative to pass, I don't think we can say until we see the results
today. And obviously the reason that everybody is paying attention to this so closely today is because Colorado is one of the first states where marijuana became legal. And now that has happened all across this country. People are wondering whether this idea of decriminalizing hallucinogenic mushrooms is going to become something that other states do.
Right. And there's definitely interest in other states. The Republican lawmaker in Iowa recently proposed a bill to legalize psilocybin for medical use and to remove it from Iowa's list of controlled substances. And a group in California tried to get a decriminalization on their question on their ballot in 2018, but they didn't get enough signatures. So whether or not it's gaining traction, it certainly has some interest.
That is Avery Lill from Colorado Public Radio. As we wait to see what voters in Denver decide today, they could be the first city to decriminalize the use of hallucinogenic mushrooms. Avery, thank you.
Thanks, Jeremy.
Well, Robin, the Oscars of food were doled out last night in Chicago. This is the James Beard Foundation holding their annual awards. And it turns out that the nominee that we profiled last month right here on Here and Now was a big winner.
Prescient. You are so prescient.
And we figured it out. This one looks like a good one. It's Ashley Christensen of Raleigh, North Carolina, who was named Outstanding Chef. She's the owner of several restaurants in the Raleigh area and talked with me about the inspiration she gets from the city where she works.
We live in a place where we truly experience seasons, which what can be more inspiring to creative dishes? And every week there's something new and there's something fun to be inspired by and to work with.
So there you go.
Make your reservations now.
Yeah, exactly.
People,
exactly. And by the way, this is the second time in an annual tradition. Last year, we profiled this pastry chef in Birmingham, Alabama, Dollister Miles.
Exactly.
And then she won the James Beard Award for Best Pastry Chef.
I see a pattern developing
get
here.
Get in touch for
and
next year.
And that's why we must go out and eat at and interview more chefs
that's
right now.
Right. One of the schools at the center of the college admissions scandal is the University of Southern California. More than half of the parents accused by the FBI of trying to bribe their kids' way into college were targeting USC. And as it happens, that's just the tip of the scandal iceberg right now at USC. So what has all of it meant for current students there? Joining us now is Ivana Jang, who's this year's valedictorian. She's from Ohio and graduating with a degree in public policy and global studies. Ivana, welcome to Here and Now.
Thanks for having me.
And also joining us today is Trenton Stone, who's the student body president for the undergraduate student government of USC. He's from Colorado and is currently a sophomore majoring in philosophy and cognitive science with a minor in business finance. Trenton, welcome to you.
Yeah, thanks for having me today.
And I know that this is a busy week for you because of finals, so we thank you for taking the time to talk with us.
Sure thing. Ivana,
let me start with you because you're graduating. How do you feel about the college admission scandal? How has it hit you as a student at USC?
Certainly. So I think since my freshman year at USC, I've always kind of been in circles of activist students and friends who have always tried to push the needle with the university in terms of diversity, inclusion, equity, and ways to take advantage of all the resources at the university for all students. So I think when the scandal came out, my friends and I were honestly just not surprised. It didn't quite come as much of a shock to us. Certainly it was disappointing, and it is disappointing to have like family and friends and everybody come together this Friday in the light of all of that.
Why is that? Because you think that some of the people who are going to be on stage with you don't deserve to be there or what?
Well, and this will be something that I think I'll mention in my speech as well, but I feel that there could be a more honest conversation about what the priorities of the university are. And I think those in power just don't have that same perspective of, I attended some of the presidential search committee hearing sessions, and there it was just the folks on the committee, there was a lot of, I'm a 12th generation Trojan or whatever that is, and I'm not. I'm a first generation Vietnamese American. I'm not a first gen student, but coming from a background where my parents were forced out of their country and had to rebuild a life here, and my mom had to drop out of community college because she was pregnant with me. Yeah, there's definitely, it's disappointing, but I'm happy to be validated, I guess, for my achievements. And I hope that in the future, we can put a spotlight on this underrepresented students at campus as well.
But it also makes it all the more disappointing to think that somebody may have bought their way into the school.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Trenton, what about you? How has the college admissions scandal affected you personally?
Yeah, no, thanks, Ivana, for sharing that. I think for me, you know, I'm in this position now for about a month. I'm 2 years into USC and still have two more years to go. So I think a lot of what I've been focusing on is how do I deal with my first half of college and then how to move forward and not only reconcile with our past, but really focus on a future that can drive change. As you might have heard and know, there's a lot of change in leadership. We have a new president, many new senior administrators and deans across USC. And I think really what we want to focus on and what we want to do is make sure that the changing leadership isn't just a check mark that, you know, we're going to make change, but that that truly does happen.
Do you think that the system can truly be fixed when you've got people that are wealthy and powerful who want to make sure that they can be at the front of the line to get in?
Yeah, and I don't want to be overly optimistic. I think there will always be challenges, but I do think that now with the culmination of scandal after scandal, just in the last 2 years since I accepted my admissions offer, there's been multiple scandals, and I think all of it's culminated now to this point. That change truly can happen. Everyone across the university and across the U.S., especially with this admissions scandal, recognizes a lot of the institutional challenges across the college ecosystem. And so I think there's now a moment to make that change, but I don't think that it'll be perfect just in this next year. I think it's a long term, and I think it takes people like Ivana at the forefront really driving that change and being there to really hold people accountable to make that change in progress.
Okay, well, let's talk about some of those other scandals that you're referencing there. there have been scandals relating to sexual misconduct. One involves George Tyndall, the former campus gynecologist, has been accused of sexually abusing patients at the USC Student Health Clinic over 3 decades. He continued to see patients until 2017 and resigned quietly with a payout. The university is facing hundreds of civil suits from former patients because of Tyndall. Ivana, what did you think when you heard about that scandal?
I was really crushed because as a student who uses the health center, as a woman on campus, it was really scary, I think, to think that that could have been me. And to be honest, it was many of my friends. And last summer, I was interning in Senator Feinstein's office and was just browsing through weekly reports and happened to see a blurb on this scandal. And that was just, it was really crushing, I think, for me and the other USC student who was interning there at the time. And to know that, you know, I had been abroad the previous semester, to know that I was coming back to a campus that was going to be grappling with this. And it was disheartening. But yeah, so that was a dark moment, I think, for a lot of students.
Well, and Trenton, after the Tyndall revelations, you learned that your own former campus doctor, Dennis Kelly, who's a men's sexual health practitioner, had been accused of sexual battery and harassment. He was known for counseling LGBTQ patients and denied any inappropriate behavior, but several men have come forward with a lawsuit against him and USC. What about that one? How upsetting was it to learn about that?
Yeah. I think that added on to, you know, the Tyndall situation. And I received a note from Dr. Kelly in July of last year after our president had resigned in May, about his resignation from his post. And then it wasn't until February that the scandal broke that he had from the lawsuit that he had been potentially harassing and assaulting students in our health center. And so I think for me personally, having been a patient of Dr. Kelly and as a student on campus, it really just added on to this complexity and this multi-leveled situation at USC. And I think it really just showed larger systematic issues across our health system rather than simply just, you know, one bad egg in this health center.
So both of you have had to deal with your fair share of college scandals during your time there at USC. But aside from all of that, have you been able to, you know, focus on being a college student? It's a once in a lifetime opportunity. I'll start with you, Ivana, and just, you know, keep focused on learning and socializing and doing all the things that college students do.
Oh, definitely. I mean, I think, yeah, I've been able to, like I said, I've interned in Senator Feinstein's office. I've been able to work and study abroad in places like Uganda and Nicaragua because of the opportunities offered through USC. So I think there are people in USC who want us to take advantage of these opportunities and want us to reach our full potential. And I've been very fortunate to be a part of that. And I think it comes down to bringing that spirit, I guess, what it means to have that college experience of taking advantage of academics, extracurriculars, and opportunities to travel. And I think that's there. And I think we just need to understand and get all this on the same page, I guess, about wanting that for every single student at USC and not just a privileged few.
And what about you, Trenton? Have you been able to focus just on being a student?
Yeah, I think that's always at the foundation of why we're at school, but it Of course, student government and different endeavors do take a lot of time and end up pulling a lot of myself away from academics. But I think being able to focus on as a student, you know, there's unparalleled opportunities at USC. Similar to Ivana, I've been able to participate in so many different programs and trips and really just been able to develop so much as a person. So I think while these scandals and situations pose a very interesting challenge, not only for students, but for the larger university, the university continues to operate and be a great place and a great hub for academics and extracurriculars and professional development. And so, you know, I love USC, but I think that that even, you know, requires more of us to be able to make sure that we're a part of that change and that we don't just, you know, write off the university, but that we can be a part of what needs to happen over the next coming years.
Ivana, what's next for you after you graduate?
I'll be going back home to Ohio for the summer just to take a break for the few months. And then I accepted a fellowship through Princeton in Asia to teach English at a college in Vietnam for the next academic year.
Wow.
And then
be
after
fun.
That, I'll think about grad school. But yeah, it'll be fun for the time. Yeah.
And Trenton, what about you? I know you're 2 years away from graduation, but what are you thinking about for your future?
Yeah, yeah. This summer, I'm going to be doing a lot of work for this position. I'll be in LA for about half the summer, and then I'm going to head to Cambridge University to do a research program with a faculty member there. So I'm super excited about that. And then after that, I'm just going to continue with my education, finish out the next year as president. And then I'm really excited for my senior year just to be a regular student and kind of just enjoy my time at USC and make sure that everything finishes out well. And then after that, we'll see what happens.
That is Trenton Stone and Ivana Jang. They are students at the University of Southern California. Ivana is graduating this week. Thanks to both of you. Ivana, congratulations. We really appreciate both of you talking with us.
Thanks so much for having us.
Yes, thank you so much.
This message comes from Here and Now's sponsor, Ember Wave. Ember Wave. The revolutionary new personal thermostat that is designed to help you find thermal wellness in any situation. Ember Wave can put you in control of your comfort in places like your freezing office, uncomfortable airplanes, cold restaurants, after a workout, at home, and more. Named one of Time Magazine's best inventions of 2018. Learn more at emberwave.com. Ember Wave, balance through temperature.
Markets here in the U.S. took another dive at the open today after U.S. Trade Representative Robert Lighthizer promised yesterday that the president's threatened tariff hike on Chinese goods, up to 25% from 10%, will happen just after midnight Friday. Despite that threat today, China's government said its top trade envoy will be in Washington Thursday to continue trade talks. Ali Velshi is MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent. Ali, we want to get a sense of what's going on here.
Well, yeah, it's a complicated situation. The Chinese team, you know, decided to sort of pull back from the talks a little bit, and Donald Trump decided to get tougher. He decided that he's going to impose new sanctions. So the Chinese team is now coming to Washington on Thursday and Friday. Remember, the sanctions are the increased sanctions are meant to be imposed on Friday. It would seem at this point that Donald Trump may have the upper hand, but the point is, in both cases, in the case of China and the United States, both have had things that have made them feel like they're in a stronger negotiating position over the last couple of weeks. And so everybody's digging in as opposed to getting closer to a deal.
Well, tell us what that is. Why does each feel stronger?
Well, the United States, you know, stock market performance, economic growth, low unemployment. Donald Trump is sort of getting the message that the tariff war, the trade war that he started, is not having a particularly negative effect on the economy. It's certainly costing American consumers a little bit more money, but it's not fundamentally affecting the economy. On the other hand, China is trying to reestablish its global dominance through something called the Belt Road Initiative, One Belt, One Road, you might know it as, or the New Silk Road. And they had a major conference at which 40 different heads of state were there, and it sort of boosted China's confidence that the world wants to do business with China so it can take a tougher position with the United States. So I think China may have overplayed its hand on this one, threatening to pull back on the talks. Donald Trump says he'll impose more tariffs. That is the biggest sticking point for China. Yeah. It doesn't want more tariffs.
Well, the president's top economic advisor said yesterday that China is reneging on some commitments. We know that the U.S. wants a list of law and regulations that will needed to be revised for China to comply with the deal. They want to have a checklist there. Beijing is balking at that.
Yeah.
But what do you make of former Trump advisor Steve Bannon's op-ed in the Washington Post today? He lays this out in really stark terms. He says we're in an economic war with China. He says his advisors might be pushing him to make any kind of deal just so he doesn't lose voters. But Bannon says, you know, it should be a tough deal. And so does Democratic Senator Chuck Schumer. He tweeted out, hang tough.
So there's not only bipartisan support on being tough on China, there's global support, right? If President Trump hadn't started a trade war with all our partners, like Canada and the European allies, everybody'd be louder in their support of Donald Trump. There is definitely a feeling that Donald Trump has taken on China in a way that prior administrations hadn't done. Steve Bannon really lays out a very strong argument in an op-ed in the Washington Post about how the new world is America versus China. I don't know that I can justify the solutions he comes out with, and that we shouldn't make a deal with China. But he does lay out the reasons why it's really important that the United States not look for a short term or simple deal, but look for something more comprehensive. What he sees as a more comprehensive deal is not necessarily what everybody else sees, but he does make the point that this is a big global battle. China is the dominant other player in the world. They are growing and they are ascendant.
Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor, economics correspondent. He's also co-host of Velshi and Rule, and telling us a little bit about a story we will be following this week. Ali, thank you.
Thank you.
The Me Too movement has been a game changer for many women, but what about men? Well, in Wyoming, there's a new victim advocacy group that's designed to allow men to discuss the problems of sexual violence with other men and help them become better advocates for women. Wyoming Public Radio's Maggie Mullen reports from the Mountain West News Bureau.
Safe Project in Laramie is a cluster of beige buildings in a mostly residential neighborhood.
Hi.
Libby Garish answers the door. She's worked here for the past year as a victim advocate. She tells me that historically, there haven't been a lot of sexual assault and domestic violence prevention programs that reach out to men.
It's kind of a up-and-coming buzz right now, is engaging men in the work in gender-based violence.
And it's a buzz Garish wants to be a part of. So she developed the Safe Men program as an experiment. It takes 10 men from the community and puts them through an intensive training over 12 months. They'll meet about once a month.
We're trying to have them be basically gender-based violence almost experts in a whole year, which of course we're not going to accomplish.
Garish says there's a reason the program is spread over a year.
If you were to condense this into 2 weeks, that would be a very depressing 2 weeks, and I don't think it would be really enough time to process that.
And there's a lot to cover. Garish says after an initial meet and greet, they get down to the stark realities.
We're going to be talking about sexual assault. We're going to be talking about stalking, child abuse, community organizing, basically everything that falls under the umbrella of gender-based violence.
I know there's a problem.
That's Jason Savari. When he heard about the program, he jumped at the chance of getting involved.
How do I address it? How do I become active against the problem, if that makes sense? And I didn't have many answers to that.
Savari says there wasn't really a space where he could talk about things like gender-based violence with other men. And that's a huge part of the idea behind the project, to create that space.
If it feels like a stupid question or something that you feel uncomfortable asking, that's okay, because that gets the conversation going.
Uncomfortable questions like, why does someone experiencing domestic violence stay with their abuser? Or what are the nuances of consent? The project looked for men from all kinds of backgrounds. Savari is an academic advisor at the University of Wyoming. There's also a teacher in the group, a business owner, a therapist, someone in the medical field, and a police officer, Detective Sergeant Ton Smith.
Dealing with gender-based violence more frequently than most people, I had a lot to bring to the table.
Smith is coming up on his 15-year anniversary with the Laramie Police Department. He says a lot of his caseload involves sexual assault, and something he and the other program participants noticed is how frequently people misunderstand sexual violence.
we realize that society has really relaxed views on what constitutes sexual assault and domestic violence.
But Smith is still optimistic about shifting those views, and so is Livy Garish. She says once you learn and get involved with sexual violence prevention, it's like flipping a light switch.
And sometimes that light switch is hard to turn off. It's something that you're always going to be aware of and something that you're always going to want to do more and know more about. And I think based on the men in our program this year, I can definitely see that being the case for them.
The Safe Men program turned away 50 applicants who wanted in on the first round of workshops. Garish hopes it's just the first of many. For Here and Now, I'm Maggie Mullen in Laramie.
We are in full-blown spring. Stuff appearing in produce sections you may have no idea what to do with. Maybe rhubarb, those green and pink stalks that if you bite them are... Whoa! Here in our resident chef, Kathy Gunst, is here with recipes to tame that tartness. Kathy, correct?
There you go. Tame the tartness.
You know, I grew up on Long Island a while ago, and we used to pick rhubarb from the side of the road and, and chew on it. And it really was tough.
That is super sour. I mean, most people don't like eating raw rhubarb because it is just a pow of sourness.
Right. But what
tartness.
What is it?
Technically, it's a vegetable, but in 1947, in a New York court, it was declared a fruit.
Wait, it went to court?
It went to court. What fruit or vegetable has been to court that you know of? But in 1947, it went to court and it was declared a fruit because it's most often cooked as one in the U.S. And then there's some long-winded explanation about how businesses who imported the stalks saved money on taxes because it was no longer considered a vegetable.
Wow.
I don't know. But let's talk about the good parts.
Yes, shall we? Because you have some dishes here, and oh, I can't wait. It can be in sweet or savory dishes?
Absolutely. A while ago, I did a recipe here for grilled rhubarb with pork chops. Mm. I put raw rhubarb on the grill and brushed it with maple syrup, and it softens and sweetens. The thing about rhubarb is that because it's so sour, it needs to be balanced out by sugar. The problem is most people add too much sugar. Mm-hmm. So when you eat rhubarb, all you taste is the sugar. You have a strawberry rhubarb crumble in front of you. This is very simple. I cooked a little rhubarb in a little bit of sugar, let it cook down and soften, and I mixed it with some fresh strawberry slices and made a topping with my favorite granola, which has nuts, a little bit of ginger. That's it. You make it ahead. I popped it in the freezer. This morning I took it out, put it in the oven, and now you are eating it.
Yes, I sure am. This is amazing.
And it's very, very simple and a great way to take advantage of rhubarb by sweetening it but not overloading it.
Okay. And then what do we have over here?
We have a rhubarb cake.
Oh,
the recipe comes from my dear friend, Rebecca Schultz. It can be made in start to finish in about an hour and a half. You cut rhubarb. You sprinkle it with sugar, which softens it. You could use ginger or cinnamon. Beat up some butter and eggs and flour and buttermilk. Buttermilk gives it this rich taste without it being very heavy.
You know, I was just going to say it's so light.
It's a very light cake. And then I just took some strawberries, sprinkled them with sugar overnight, and you have a pretty elegant dessert.
By the way, how do you get those strawberries overnight to have like a sauce?
What they do is the strawberries and the sugar become friendly, and the juices from the strawberries are released, and you get this almost natural sugar syrup.
That's all you have to do?
That's it.
Oh, okay.
It's called maceration.
Wonderful.
It's a wonderful 5-minute cooking term that will make you feel very special.
With a big word. Okay.
The big word.
This.
This is a drink. So I thought, ooh, what about a rhubarb soda? So here's what I did. I took a quarter cup of sugar, and I put it in a saucepan for 5 minutes. Now, don't get scared. I made what's called a caramel. So I let it cook until it just starts to liquefy. Then I added a tiny bit of maple syrup.
Wait, the sugar alone?
The sugar alone. That's how you make caramel, yes.
Okay.
It's like burnt sugar is what it is. I add the maple syrup. Then I added a cup of water, and I have this gorgeous caramel sweet syrup. Then I added 2 cups of large rhubarb chopped up, and let it simmer for a few minutes. And I added it with ice cubes and soda water, and you have the most refreshing drink of the season.
You know, that's a challenge I'm willing to take. Let me see.
All right, mm-hmm. You're on.
Most refreshing drink of the season right here.
Now,
let me
take it up a notch. You could add a little bit of apple cider vinegar, and it would be a shrub, which would just make your soda a mm-hmm. little more interesting. And then let the party begin. You could add rum. You could add tequila. But just on its own, I would drink that morning, noon, and night.
Yeah, it's nice and light and no aftertaste.
Completely.
Boy, we will have all of this at hereandnow.org. How do you store rhubarb, and how do you shop for it?
When you're looking for rhubarb, the best place to go is farmer's market, where you want to look for tender, thin stalks. The fat ones tend to get fibrous. You can cook with them. They're delicious. But the tender, thin ones are really special. And you want to look for a stalk that's got a deep pink, almost a reddish streak through it. The pale ones are a little bit undeveloped. The important thing is that sometimes they're sold with the leaves still attached. Mm-hmm. The leaves are poisonous.
I was just going to say, because it's, you know, if you see it on the side of the road, people have said it's poisonous.
It is. The leaves contain something called oxalic acid, which is a poisonous substance and something you want to stay away from.
I'm glad I survived my childhood.
Exactly, right? So many of us, and you always hear to keep dogs away from rhubarb mm-hmm. plants, and that's exactly why. You want to cut off the leaves, wash them and dry them and refrigerate them. And they'll last over a week. You can also cut them and freeze them. And then you can cook with them all year.
Fantastic. Aunt Kathy, you've done it again. Thank you.
Happy spring.
Same to you.
Uber goes public on Friday, and the company is expected to be valued around $90 billion. That has a lot of Uber drivers, as well as drivers for the company's main competitor, Lyft, saying, where's ours? Drivers in cities across the country, including New York, Los Angeles, and Washington, D.C., are planning to strike tomorrow to call attention to wage cuts and a business model they say is exploiting workers. For more on this, let's go to our weekly guide to the world of tech, Recode. Kara Swisher is editor-at-large at Recode and joins us now. Hi, Kara.
Hi, how you doing?
Doing well. So the organizers of this strike say they want major reforms to the industry to make it fair, dignified, and sustainable. What do they want Uber to do?
Well, they want to give them a bigger cut. I mean, I think that's really at the center of it, is how much does Uber take from each driver, and how do they parse out drivers, and what are the formulas so that these people make more money an hour, you know, up to $17 an hour, versus what they say, which is that given the cost of the cars and everything else and the way Uber runs the system, is that basically we're riding on their labor without them being paid fairly.
And is that something that Uber could do if they wanted to do it right now, given that they've got this big IPO coming up and they're going to raise a lot of money?
Well, there's two things. There's the big IPO, and the fact that if you look at the numbers that Uber is showing in the IPO, is they lose a lot of money. And so one of the costs, of course, is drivers. And the question is this a sustainable economic model? It's really the bigger question. And so that's the question. Adding costs to Uber will be even more problematic for the IPO. It's already down. I think it was used to be valued at $120 billion. Now it's $90 billion. And so even though that seems like an enormous number, people are definitely worried about the economics of these businesses.
Is it a sustainable business model? I mean, you look at Uber and you think they must be able to make a ton of money with everybody using Uber all the time, and they don't have a lot of cost because it is just basically the drivers who are putting wear and tear on their own vehicles.
Well, no, they've been growing all over the place. So I think one of the, and adding to their businesses. And so if you just look at the numbers, no, and neither does Lyft. And that's why Lyft has had such a difficult time on the market, because of these enormous losses, and Ubers are quantumly larger. And so that's the question, is how do you get to profitability at these companies? How long do they have to grow? There's a lot of competitive pressure between the two companies, for example, in the US market. And then Uber is global, and so it has competitors all across the globe.
Are things getting worse for the drivers themselves? They talk about wage cuts, or do they just feel that they have a better hand right now with these IPOs?
Well, I think in this new economy, this ride-sharing economy, you have, you know, these jobs are not employees. And so sometimes Uber says they give them all kinds of benefits and things like that. And most of them just want more money, from when I talk to them, when you ask anybody in a car. And so there's all kinds of benefits that they say they're giving them. And I think the question is, can you build a sustainable business where these people are not employees, and so Uber doesn't have the responsibility of them as employees, even though they call them partners. And so what these partners want is more of the economic cut. And if they take more of the economic cut, Uber's business is not valued at quite the numbers that they're being valued at. So it's a problematic situation. And it's very much undercut by the idea of what happens when autonomous driving moves into here. Mm-hmm. That becomes a much better business because they don't have to pay the drivers at all because these are autonomous cars, although that's very, very far into the future.
Far into the future. There have been a lot of calls for more regulation of tech companies in general. Do you see more regulation coming for Uber and Lyft as lawmakers say, you know, we need to make sure that there's regulation that says the drivers have to be paid X amount or have to get certain benefits?
Well, I think all of tech can't avoid a lot of regulation. And the question is, who's paying for this wealth that's being created and where it's being transferred to, when some of the founders of Uber are going to make, you know, $10 billion, become that wealthy? The drivers are alleging, and I think they've got a very good case for it, that it's off the backs of their labor, that their labor is being exploited in order for other people to get wealthy. And the question is, what are they owed? Are they part of what made Uber great? Of course they are. And what are they owed as part of that?
What sense do you get about where the customers will stand in all of this? If Uber drivers and Lyft drivers decide to go on strike, even if they do it regularly or more frequently than they have been, are customers going to say, yeah, okay, I'm not going to take an Uber, I'm not going to take a Lyft? Or are they going to say, look, I got to get where I'm going, I'll do what I have to do?
Yeah, that's the problem. I think people like the low prices, right? You like when the prices go up, you start to go, oh, that costs the same as a cab. You know what I mean? The prices are extraordinarily low. And so I think that's who's benefited the most is our customers who've gotten these sort of a free ride. And, you know, Uber's making the argument that a lot of these people, most of the people drive only a little bit and they do it to supplement income. And all these arguments are not correct because most people make money and they're doing it for different reasons. You know, I think it has to all sort itself out. But in the end, riders that get these incredibly low prices are the ones that benefit the most. And that the question is, will these prices go up and will they continue to ride if these prices go up? And will they stop riding in order to try to help the drivers? And that's the whole point of a strike, if people will go along with that and not use Uber as much.
That's Kara Swisher, editor-at-large at Recode. Kara, thanks as always.
Thanks a lot.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.